From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We are following the news that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is bringing three Americans who've been detained in North Korea back to the United States, a gesture from North Korea ahead of the potential meeting between Kim Jong-un and President Trump. And it comes a day after Trump announced he's pulling the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. In Iran today, hardline lawmakers set a copy of the agreement on fire in Parliament, amid chants of death to America. Joining us now is Fred Pleitgen, CNN senior international correspondent. He's in Tehran, and he joins us on Skype. Fred, tell us more about what happened in the Iranian parliament today.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a show, Jeremy. Apparently, there were some hardline members of parliament who went up to the front of the lectern, and then they took not just an American flag, but also a copy of the actual nuclear agreement out, and then set both on fire and chanted death to America, which is sort of a fairly common chant among hardliners here at demonstrations as well. They then accused the U.S. of obviously breaking its word, that the U.S. was unreliable. There was a lot that went with it as well. Do you know what I think is actually quite interesting is at the same time, the Iranian president is still saying that he might want to try and salvage the nuclear agreement and make it just between Iran, the European countries, China and Russia, but then without the United States.
That's President Hassan Rouhani, who is seen as a moderate. Is his job at risk because of this?
Yeah, you know what? I think in the long term, it certainly might be. I mean, President Rouhani has really staked a lot on the nuclear agreement. And he essentially told Iranians the last time that he was elected that, you know, there would be big economic benefits from the nuclear agreement. And even while it was in place, that really wasn't happening to the extent that many people wanted. The jobs weren't pouring in. Foreign direct investment was a problem because many European companies fear that there might be American backlash if they invest in Iran. There's also a lot of bureaucratic red tape here in Iran as well, to be fair. Now, of course, with the nuclear agreement now so much in jeopardy, all that is going to get even worse. So that could be a very, very big problem for him.
The supreme leader of Iran also spoke today. What did he say?
Well, the supreme leader, that's really one of the most interesting things. So the supreme leader, as you would expect, he ripped into President Trump. He said President Trump's corpse would be fodder for worms, but Iran would still be here. But in a more nuanced way, he also said that he does not trust the European countries, but he does say, or he seemed to indicate, that maybe there was a chance for the same kind of sort of smaller agreement that President Hassan Rouhani is also talking about as well. So it seems as though there's a certain degree of political unity among the hardliners around Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, and President Rouhani, at least to move forward with this course at this point. But at the same time, of course, there are also hardliners who are attacking Rouhani as well. But it was a bit of a nuanced statement, but also mixed in with a lot of pretty nasty words for the U.S. president.
What will a return of sanctions mean for ordinary Iranians, for Iran's economy, which we're reading is already in free fall now?
That's a really, really good question, because you could already see this really in the run-up to President Trump's announcement. The rial, the local currency here, has been tanking, and it's obviously increased prices a great deal. There was one driver I was talking to today who said the car that he bought 2 years ago now is twice as expensive just because the currency has devalued to the extent that it has. And of course, a lot of the other prices are like that as well. At the same time, wages have not been rising. There's no jobs coming in. It's very difficult for the Iranians to get investment. And for the Europeans going to resist if America says, look, your companies, if they do business with Iran, they're going to get sanctioned by America. Which side are the European companies going to choose? I think right now there is not a lot of optimism. You know, I've been in Iran so many times now, and around 2015, when the nuclear agreement was put in place, there was so much optimism here in this country. There were people who thought that finally, you know, their economic power could be unleashed. There's so many young, well-educated people here who are just being held back by the fact that this country has been under sanctions and has been isolated. And now you can really see that optimism is pretty much all but gone now after President Trump said what he said yesterday.
I want to ask you one more question while we have you. You're usually based in Moscow, and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is there meeting with President Putin today. They're reportedly talking about Syria. Are there worries right now that we're getting closer to a war between Israel and Iran?
Yes. Right now is a very, very dangerous situation with the conflict between Iran and Syria really growing. The Israelis, you know, seemingly conducting more and more airstrikes on Syrian territory. for a very long time, I think the fight against ISIS was something that sort of held these sides apart, but that now really seems to be going away. So I do think there is big conflict potential, especially now, if the nuclear agreement falls apart, if there is a period after which the Iranians believe that the agreement is no longer valuable and they might give it up, then I do think that there could be a real threat of direct conflict there. And of course, the big question then would be, if you look at the Russians in Syria, they are by far the most powerful force there. Would they be able to keep the Israelis and the Iranians apart? Because we have had situations in the past where the Iranians, for instance, flew a drone into Israel, into Israeli airspace. That got shot down. The Israelis retaliated with massive airstrikes, and the Russians really had to tone that situation down between these two sides. Are they going to be able to do that? How will the U.S. react? I think that is going to be a big, big question. There's a gigantic potential there for a wider conflict that could degenerate very quickly.
That's Fred Pleitgen, who is CNN's senior international correspondent, joining us from Tehran in Iran. Fred, great reporting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, more details are emerging about President Trump's lawyer Michael Cohen and the company through which Cohen paid porn actress and director Stormy Daniels for her silence in the run-up to the election about her alleged affair with Trump. The company, Essential Consultants LLC, is a shell company, in other words, just used for financial transactions. According to documents reviewed by the New York Times, it took in $4.4 million just before the president was elected through January. It included hundreds of thousands from a company controlled by a Russian oligarch with ties to the Kremlin, and hundreds of thousands more from big-time corporations like AT&T and Novartis, who say they contracted with Cohen for consulting work. NPR's justice correspondent Ryan Lucas is here. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
And could you walk us through this? When did Essential Consultants form, and how exactly is it connected to Cohen?
Well, Cohen himself set up this this limited liability company in Delaware in mid-October of 2016, so about 3 weeks before the presidential election here in the U.S. This is, of course, the company that that Cohen used to make that $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels as part of that non-disclosure agreement. Trump, of course, denies that there was any affair with Stormy Daniels, but Trump, Cohen, and Essential Consultants LLC are all mentioned in the lawsuit that Stormy Daniels has brought against all of them.
Well, and the company's financial transaction summary came from Stormy Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, but at least four companies confirmed to NPR independently that they had hired Cohen or the shell company he formed to make the payment to Daniels. And Avenatti speculated about that on CNN last night.
It appears that this may be your typical pay-to-play type scenario where you have someone close to a politician, in this case close to the President of the United States, which is highly unusual, selling access, potential access, to the President of the United States.
Ryan, that's quite the allegation, especially since in October 2016, AT&T announced that it planned to buy Time Warner, the parent company of CNN. Trump, of course, opposes that deal. So, at first blush, are there legal lines crossed here?
It's really hard to say because we just don't have enough details at this point. Avenatti himself hasn't provided any of the underlying evidence for the claims that he's making. You know, the companies that he mentions, we have contacted. They have acknowledged that they engaged Essential Consultants. The timing, as you note, is certainly questionable. What we do know at this point is this. AT&T says that it hired Essential Consultants for, quote, insights into understanding the new administration, says it wasn't about lobbying or legal work. Novartis, a big pharmaceutical company, says it was a one-year deal focused on U.S. healthcare and policy matters. Now, Novartis also says that it was contacted in 2017 by special counsel Robert Mueller's team about its agreement with Cohen. Another company, Korea Aerospace Industries, says it hired Essential Consultants for a consulting regarding U.S. accounting practices. And then Columbus Nova, a private equity company, said that it brought on Cohen for consulting on potential sources of capital and real estate investments. So, four very different explanations for what it is these companies were hiring Cohen for.
We have to get to the Russian oligarch, Vekselberg. Both Rudy Giuliani and the president said Cohen was paid back. Giuliani said he was paid back through retainer fees. But now Avanti, the Stormy Daniels lawyer, is asking if that Russian oligarch also put money into the same company that paid Stormy Daniels, could he actually have paid her? But putting that aside, Vekselberg did go to the inaugurations. What do we know about the company that he backed that made the payments?
Well, Columbus Nova is a company based in the U.S. It's basically an investment vehicle. It is run by Vekselberg's cousin. One of the main investors in Columbus Nova is a group called Renova Group, big investment company that Vekselberg is the chairman of. And Vekselberg himself, of course, was sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury just last month, actually, for the ties that he allegedly has with President Putin and the Kremlin's inner circle.
So this information is all not new to federal investigators. We'll continue to follow how this might impact the Mueller investigation with NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thank you for laying that out.
Thank you.
LuLaRoe, the clothing company, not to be confused with Lululemon, the yoga wear company, LuLaRoe has become the Tupperware of apparel. The way it works is that women, called consultants, sign up to sell the company's bright leggings and dresses out of their homes. We'll have pictures at herenow.org. At one point, it's estimated there were 150,000 women selling in 50 states, some making thousands a month. Last year, LuLaRoe hit $2.3 billion in sales. Well, it's estimated the company now has less than half that sales force, 63,000 women, and they're not making as much. Thousands of consultants have left. There have been lawsuits, and last fall, a class action suit alleging that LuLaRoe is a scam. A couple weeks ago, that case was moved to arbitration. LuLaRoe is what's called a multi-level marketing company, an MLM. There are a few mentors at the top, thousands of saleswomen consultants at the bottom, who can work their way up to trainer or coach, the people who bring more saleswomen in. It's what's called a pyramid structure. It's legal. But the suits allege that LuLaRoe is an illegal pyramid scheme. Claire Suddeth has been looking into this for Bloomberg Businessweek. So, Claire, how should this work with MLMs? How much money do women usually invest to become saleswomen?
So most of these companies, it costs maybe $100, $200 to buy into this and get your first package of inventory of whatever it is.
Like Mary Kay, yeah.
Mary Kay is about $100. LuLaRoe is unusual in that the prices have changed over the years, but on average, women have spent about $7,000, sometimes upwards to $10,000, to buy in, and that's just the initial inventory package.
So the company sends them out these, you know, bins of clothing, leggings and these dresses, and that's the $7,000. And they put in their garages and sell it from their home.
Yeah.
So this is a pyramid. There are women at the bottom who buy this inventory. They sell it. And women in the middle, the more women they can get to do that, they make commission. And there is legal precedent as to how this is supposed to work to keep it from going from a pyramid to a pyramid scheme. There was a federal standard, you remind us, that was established after 1972, saying a company can compensate people for bringing in those new sellers, but the compensation can't be based on how much inventory they buy, but how much they sell? Explain that.
Exactly. So essentially, the difference between a legitimate MLM company and something that is possibly a pyramid scheme is, what is the intention of the company? If your intention is to sell a product and you just use this hierarchical structure to do it, that's fine, but you have to base it on sales. So if I convince you to also buy leggings, and I'm getting a commission, I need to make sure that you're actually selling those leggings through to another customer.
Right. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. When LuLaRoe was launched, the founders did not do that. They based the compensation for the women bringing saleswomen in on how much inventory those women bought, not on how much they sold. So right at the beginning, they were in trouble. And then, as you tell the story, the co-founder, Deanne Stidham, and her husband had a big event at Disneyland to bring more women in. They had 11,000 people sign up the next day. They were not prepared for how many people were going to get on board.
No. You know, it was a combination of the people who are already part of the company realized that they could make a lot of money because of this wholesale-based compensation.
Right.
But on top of that, these clothes were very popular. And so a lot of women wanted to buy them and a lot of women wanted to sell them. And so when they started doing these national tours that would essentially inspire people to come on to the company as consultants, you know, they just really built it up as this, you know, self-empowering thing. You can stay at home and take care of your kids and make thousands of dollars a month. And they started getting women joining by the tens of thousands. At one point, they were signing up people, about 500 people a day, every day for months.
Hmm. That's why in the very beginning, there were women who were making like, you know, thousands a month. But you talked to Eleni Cattell, a stay-at-home mom in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Last year, she went from selling $12,000 a month of clothing to just a couple thousand because she said there were 70 consultants just in Myrtle Beach, 70 other women that she knew of competing for those sales. There was no one to sell them to.
Yeah. So no matter how popular these clothes are, you're still going to have a limited number of people who are actually able and willing to buy these leggings, even though they're selling on Facebook to all over the country. Essentially, women started getting stuck with clothes that they couldn't sell.
And I'm wondering if the people in the middle, the women who are making money by bringing other women in, the company did realize that it had to base the compensation for the people who recruited saleswomen on the sales, not just how much inventory the women bought. So suddenly they're making a lot less too, right? Because the women aren't selling as much.
Exactly. One of the women is named Roberta Blevin. She's 37. She lives outside San Diego. And for, I think, 17 years or so, she had been a hairstylist. And she was looking at this. She has two kids as a way to sort of supplement that income that she was making. And she signed on in 2016, was making a bunch of money. And so she actually quit her hairstylist job because she was making more selling LuLaRoe. She grew a team underneath her to about 75 people. And then she started realizing as the company is ballooning and she's not seeing what's happening, you know, behind the scenes, but she starts getting clothes that she says she received a lot of wet and smelly leggings. She tried to, you know, return them. And she had to fight with the company for a month. And there was a lot of other stuff that happened. And then when LuLaRoe switched over to the sales-based compensation plan, all these people underneath her had left. Her bonus checks dried up. And she struggled for several months trying to figure out what to do. And eventually she quit LuLaRoe. She went back to her hairstylist job at the same salon that she was at before.
And talk a little bit about the aspect that many women spoke to you about. The founders are Mormon. In the literature they give to the prospective saleswomen, it talks about empowering families and women able to stay at home. And you met with women who said that they were actually told they should be subservient to their husbands.
Yeah, some of the women who worked their way up high enough in the company as mentors at the top of the pyramid who had these teams underneath them when they would deal with the Stidhams directly. One woman in particular, she was having trouble in her marriage, and they recommended to her that she be subservient to her husband. A number of women said that they were pressured to have their husbands come on and sell LuLaRoe with them, with the idea that as a family unit, they would be stronger. Obviously, this was only people who had direct connections with the founders, but that does seem to be something that was routinely said.
Look, on one level, this is the story of an enterprising woman, Deanne Stidham, who came up with an idea she thought would empower other women. But there's all these sidebar stories. For instance, her sister would approach some of the women that started to reach the top and give them a deal to go to Mexico to get gastric bypass surgery.
Yeah, so I talked to about four different people in this story who told me the same story, and a couple of them even said that they had gotten the surgery. But essentially, Deanne or her sister, a woman named Lene, would offer to take people to Tijuana to get a gastric sleeve because in the U.S. we have fairly strict rules on who medically qualifies for gastric surgery. The rules are much more lax in Mexico.
Yeah, you're supposed to be obese and, you know, have medical issues.
Right. And this was essentially women who were a little bit overweight maybe at best. But one woman said Deanne told her to her face that she liked her mentors, the women that would get up on stage at these conventions and talk about their success at the company, to be a size smaller medium, which is especially unusual considering LuLaRoe makes clothing in all sizes. And one of its selling points is that it's for mothers who maybe aren't as confident about their bodies as they had been before. And a lot of women talked to me about how they first came to know the company through their love of the clothes and how it finally made them feel good about themselves and they could shop through this company if they're a size that maybe most clothing stores don't carry. So it's very unusual that they would be pressuring people to get gastric surgery.
Well, how is it working now? As we mentioned, there are lawsuits, people complaining about being stuck with the merchandise or the merchandise not being of the quality that it should be. Again, maybe the company just straining under the demand. But you still have 63,000 or so consultants who love LuLaRoe.
Yeah, they do still have people, there are thousands of them out there who, you know, say that maybe this was just too much work for certain people and they just couldn't cut it. And that's essentially the way things go. But they are facing about a dozen lawsuits. They had been sued for copyright infringement for allegedly taking artwork and printing it on their clothes that wasn't theirs. They had been sued for defective clothing, for clothing that was ripping after one or two wears. A lot of these cases have been settled or are still making their way through the courts. But LuLaRoe essentially got so big so quickly that the processes that had been in place that in a normal situation, a business would be able to sort of handle things properly. It was sort of like everything happened all at once. You know, when you're only a few years old and all of a sudden you have 150,000 people all over the country selling $2.3 billion worth of clothes and you're a husband and wife team, the infrastructure that you have in place is not ideal.
Yeah. By the way, what have they said?
They essentially said, you know, they had growing pains, but they feel that they acted honorably and legally, and all companies face problems like this.
So, Claire, what do you think this is a story of? You know, what is this a cautionary tale about?
I think it's a cautionary tale both for businesses. If you are going to set up a direct selling company or an MLM, you need to be sure that you are following the FTC's guidelines about how and why you should set up your company a certain way. And then for women, a lot of women get into these direct selling companies because they need a way to make money, and that's fine. But if you really look at the numbers, even the Direct Selling Association, the trade industry group, says the average, you know, income that people make from these types of companies is about $2,500 a year, which is, you know, maybe part of a vacation or something like that. But it's not a full-time income at all. And so you should be very wary of companies that claim that you can earn full-time income for part-time work.
That's Claire Sedeth of Bloomberg Businessweek. We'll link you to her deep dive into LuLaRoe clothing at hereandnow.org. Claire, thanks.
Thank you.
And what's your LuLaRoe experience? Our colleague Sister swears by it. Let us hear from you at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And President Trump's nominee to be the next director of the CIA faced tough questions today from the Senate Intelligence Committee about her role in the waterboarding of terrorism suspects after 9/11. Gina Haspel spent decades undercover as a CIA officer, including at a secret so-called black site prison in Thailand. Her nomination has reignited the debate about torture and America's counterterrorism operations, which Haspel addressed in her opening statement to the committee.
Having served in that tumultuous time, I can offer you my personal commitment, clearly and without reservation, that under my leadership, on my watch, CIA will not restart a detention and interrogation program.
Let's bring in NPR's national security correspondent, Greg Myrie. Greg, she was at that black site in Thailand where terrorism suspects were waterboarded in 2002. First, just give us a little tiny thumbnail on the thinking then about waterboarding outside U.S. territories, the debate that raged and what the thinking then became, that it, you know, was not just un-American but ineffective, and what she said today about using those techniques then.
Right. So this was 2002, a year after the Al-Qaeda attacks, and the U.S. had captured several senior al-Qaeda figures. They set up this black site prison in Thailand, and they began waterboarding. Now, we're aware of two people who were waterboarded there and a third one who was waterboarded elsewhere. Gina Haspel was there at the time, apparently not for the first, but for the second. She was pressed on this time again and said, "I do not believe in torture," but she did believe valuable information was obtained from these detainees and that it was unknowable whether the techniques, the waterboarding and other techniques, elicited that information or not.
Yeah, she was also asked about the destruction of nearly 100 videotapes of these interrogations and some waterboarding at that secret prison. Here's part of an exchange she had with Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein.
Were you an advocate for destroying the tapes?
Senator, I absolutely was an advocate if we could within and conforming to U.S. law and if we could get policy concurrence to eliminate the security risk posed to our officers by those tapes and the consistent legal advice.
And you were aware of what those tapes contained?
No, I never watched the tapes, but I understood that our officers' faces were on them and that that was very dangerous at a time when there were unauthorized disclosures that were exposing the program.
So, Greg Myrie, is that a yes?
It really is. I mean, again, we have not heard Gina Haspel. She's been undercover for almost all of her 33 years. And just to hear her talk and explain her thinking and effectively say, yes, she supported destroying the tapes because she thought it was legal.
Oh, look, this was a different time. You know, it was right post 9/11. There was a huge debate, as we said, that came out of this where many people came forward and said, in fact, the waterboarding was ineffective. Field manuals were changed for the Department of Defense, you know, for the military, whether or not they could use these techniques. Is there, did some express that sympathy that this was a different time?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I think from some of the Republican members, they said, you know, we're in a different place now. And the law has become clear. It's not only the al-Qaeda threat has diminished, but the law says you cannot torture now. There would be no real debate about what is and isn't illegal at this point.
Okay, we'll continue to follow this with NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie. Greg, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
Hawaii is making moves to help protect the future of its coral reefs. The state's governor, David Ige, is expected to sign a bill passed last week that would ban the sale of certain sunscreens that may damage coral. Meanwhile, in Australia, the government is pledging nearly $400 million to help save the Great Barrier Reef, which has been badly damaged by warming waters caused by climate change. Some scientists say it may be too late to save it. A study published last month in the journal Nature shows that a record-breaking marine heat wave on the Great Barrier Reef in 2016 caused the coral cover to decline by 30%, and in the northern section where water temperatures were highest, 50% of coral cover died in just 8 months. Joining us now is Mark Aiken, who is the coordinator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Coral Reef Watch Program. Mark, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be with you, Jeremy.
And first, just your assessment of how the Great Barrier Reef is doing at this moment.
Well, it's had a couple of bad years. We had huge marine heat waves that hit in 2016 and 2017. In 2016, the Great Barrier Reef lost about 29% of its corals, and in 2017, another 22%. All of this was a part of a global bleaching event that lasted for 3 years, from 2014 to 2017, and, you know, as I say, reached all around the world.
And it's mainly due to just warmer waters?
Absolutely. Climate change has increased water temperatures, and you add to that climate events like El Niños and La Niñas, and the high temperatures are just causing the corals to bleach and die.
When you say bleach and die, is that the same thing? If they bleach, are they dead?
No. Bleaching actually is when the corals eject the microscopic algae that live inside their tissues. They, you know, corals are animals, vegetables, and minerals. And these algae that live inside their tissues give them most of their food. And when high temperature stresses them, they eject the algae into the water column. It leaves them injured, starving, and clear looking. And so you're actually seeing right through the tissue into the skeletons. That's bleaching. If it lasts long enough, if it's severe enough, the corals will die.
And if it doesn't, how do you bring the coral back?
Well, it's not so much how do you bring them back, it's how do they bring themselves back. Mm-hmm. If it's a mild event, short-lived, and the corals will actually, they have some algae still in their tissues, and those algae will be able to reproduce and repopulate, and you get the color back. Unfortunately, the coral is still injured, it's weaker, and it's more susceptible to disease as well. So sometimes they recover, and then they die. And, of course, when the question is, how do they come back after they die? Well, they're dead. It's just a matter of having the reef come back. And that takes, you know, at least 10 to 15 years for even the fast-growing corals to come back.
So when we hear about the Australian government preparing to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to try to save the Great Barrier Reef, what is it that they're going to be spending that money on, and will it work?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I've heard different things. The majority of what they're looking at are efforts to improve water quality, and that's great because water quality does cause problems to reefs. But unless we can control climate change, just doing water quality adjustments alone are not going to be enough.
There's also a starfish that they're worried about hurting the reef, correct?
Right. The crown of thorn starfish is a predator that's been naturally occurring on reefs, but there's some evidence that under situations where there are more nutrients, you actually have more starfish. And, you know, right now the reef's in bad enough shape that any of these waves of starfish coming through are going to cause real problems. So, yes, that's another good thing, and going through and getting rid of the starfish as much as they can will help the reef. But, again, that's just a piece of the problem.
I went as a tourist years ago and went diving on the reef. It's just an incredible thing to see. I wonder if I were to go now, could I even do that at this point? Is there still enough of the reef that you would be able to look at it up close?
There is. I mean, you have to remember how big the Great Barrier Reef is. It covers the entire northeast coast of Australia. So it's you know, thousands of miles long, a couple of thousand miles long. As a result, there are some places that didn't get affected by these last two bleaching events. There are areas of the reef that are still looking quite good. And even some of the reefs that were hit, you know, weren't hit all that badly. So it all depends on where you go. But all in all, there's been a lot of damage that's occurred to the reef. First, there were reports of you know, losing a lot of the reef over the last few decades because of storms, bleaching, and crown of thorn starfish, and now we add these two new bleaching events on top of that. So there are still places to go, and I'd encourage anyone to go see it while it's still there.
Here we are talking about this in the United States. You can't get much farther away from the Great Barrier Reef than where we are right now. Why does this matter to us, the health of the Great Barrier Reef?
Well, because the Great Barrier Reef is just one of the reefs around the world that is really being affected by climate change at this point. This global bleaching event, and that's why it's important to keep it in mind that what happened in Australia was part of a global event. We had severe bleaching in Florida in 2014 and 2015. We had severe bleaching in Hawaii in 2014 and 2015. We had bleaching in Guam and the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, both U.S. territories that have actually happened four of the last 5 years. So, you know, it's all of our coral reefs. And these are amazing places that, you know, you have a billion people around the world relying on them for fish. They protect shoreline from storms and tsunamis, and they're very important economically. And so it's not just the Great Barrier Reef that we're talking about.
And is the damage as bad in other reefs?
Some were not hit that badly during this event. Some were already in bad shape and are doing very poorly. A few reefs were really devastated by this event. In fact, there's a little fly speck of a U.S. territory in the middle of the Pacific called Jarvis Island. They had 98% of their corals die. Hmm.
Now, you used the phrase a few minutes ago, you should see the reef while it's still there. There's an Australian coral researcher, Terry Hughes, who tweeted that when he showed the results of aerial surveys of bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef to his students, they wept. Are you at all optimistic about the future of the Great Barrier Reef?
Well, you know, his students aren't the only ones who wept when all that was going on. This bleaching event has been devastating, and people have been working on reefs around the world have just been heartbroken by what's occurred. But I haven't given up on coral reefs yet. The important thing, though, is, you know, for the last decade, we've been saying that the two things we have to do is, number one, we have to get climate change under control. And that's a matter of reducing the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, not just reducing emissions, but reducing carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases. Number two, we need to reduce those local stresses. And this is where their work on nutrients is, and other pollutants is very important, where the crown of thorn starfish is important, dealing with overfishing, habitat destruction, all really important. But now, we've waited so long to really do anything about these. The people are looking at very dramatic, radical conservation steps, trying to selectively breed corals to put out on the reef. There's even talk of genetic engineering. Hmm. There's talk of geoengineering, cooling the reef on large scales, either with water pumps or even making low-level clouds in areas.
What a massive undertaking that would be, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're not talking about it for all the reefs, but for sections of the reef. Yeah. And so there are other projects, that one of which I'm a part of called 50 Reefs, where we're trying to identify those reefs around the world most likely to survive during climate change and be able to reseed nearby reefs after climate change is under control. But I haven't given up hope, and I don't want anyone else to either.
Well, and do you think the Australians are doing enough, or should they be doing even more about this?
Well, you know, the Australians, along with everyone else, need to be doing their bit to deal with climate change. And so for actions to be going on one hand to help with nutrients and starfish, but on the other hand to be instituting policies that make climate change worse, that's not going to do it. So, you know, Australians, just like everyone else, we need to be addressing climate change, and we need to do it fast.
That's Mark Akin, who is the coordinator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Coral Reef Watch Program. Mark, great to talk to you once again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your interest.
And you can see photos of what's happened to the reef. They're kind of depressing at hereandnow.org.
And now to the story of the most famous life scientist you've probably never heard of. His name is Feng Jiang, and by any measure, prizes, papers, impact, he's a science superstar, one of the most inventive biological engineers in the world. He's made discoveries that have helped lead to two major advances, one in brain science, another CRISPR, the breakthrough method for editing genes. And he's 36. WBUR's Carrie Goldberg has this profile of a scientist who wants to change the world.
When Feng Jiang was 11 years old, his parents, both computer scientists, decided the American style of education would work better for him than the schools in China. Less rote learning, more hands-on.
Because I like to take things apart and break things, it would be better for me to be in a system where I'm not so confined to a specific type of learning.
Jiang didn't speak any English when his mother first brought him to Des Moines, Iowa in 1993. But he quickly impressed Ed Pilkington, a former science teacher who coordinated the high school Gifted and Talented program. He wasn't just intelligent. He had unstoppable drive.
And that's unique. I've seen students that test better than him. Not everybody is able to fail 20 experiments and then get up and then come up with something brilliant.
Jiang was soon ready for more than just classroom science. So when he was 16, he volunteered at a local gene therapy lab.
One of the very first experiments I did was to put a green fluorescent protein into a cell. And then the cell glowed green, and I thought that was magical.
And that green glowing cell was part of the gene therapy lab's effort to find new treatments for cancer.
And so to realize that you can actually build biological things that can help people. Yeah.
Jiang went to Harvard on full scholarship and then to Stanford for grad school, where he helped develop a brain science breakthrough, optogenetics, which lets researchers control neurons with light.
Feng looks around the natural world in a way that you might call almost childlike. He has kept the ability to be fascinated by everything.
Eric Lander is the director of the Broad Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Jiang is a scientist.
So when he looks at a new bacteria or some new biological process, he says, wow, that's so neat. How could I make use of that? How does it work? How might I deploy it?
And that's what Jung did with CRISPR. He and others found a way to take a sort of a molecular scissors that existed in nature and engineer it into something incredibly useful to humans, an easier way to edit genes. In early 2013, Jung published a pivotal paper showing how CRISPR could be developed to edit genes in animal and plant cells. Since then, CRISPR has been turbocharging research on cancer and malaria and genetic diseases around the world. Clinical trials that use CRISPR to correct genetic diseases are expected to begin this year.
So we're going to lab now, and this is where we do all of our experiments with cells and proteins and animals.
One of Jung's top goals is to tackle brain disease, because friends in college suffered severe mental illness.
It turns out that to correct the DNA in brain cells is fairly challenging. And so some of the recent work that we have been doing have been shifting away from DNA and moving into the RNA space.
With CRISPR expected to be worth billions to for-profit companies, Jung has been embroiled in a patent fight that's been called the Biotech Battle of the Century. It's an East Coast-West Coast conflict between the Broad and the University of California at Berkeley. Berkeley biologist Michael Eisen is definitely in the West Coast camp, but he gives Jung kudos, if with a slight edge.
He's incredibly good at scouring the obscure literature in the field and finding little pieces of things that can help them and then pouncing on them. He's sort of brutally efficient almost.
And Jung's work on CRISPR is a story of sharing as well as conflict. Through a local nonprofit, he has sent out the bits of DNA that other academic researchers need to work on CRISPR to more than 2,000 labs in 62 countries.
I think while I was growing up, my mother would always tell me you should try to do something that's useful and good for the world. And sharing is a way to be able to do good for the world.
Jung has been donating chunks of his prize money, about $1.5 million over the last couple of years, to groups that support science education. And he's on many a shortlist for the Nobel as well. Broad Institute Director Eric Lander says if there's one key to Jung's meteoric rise in science, it's that he's having fun.
The joy that comes from learning something about nature, that's why scientists do science. And Feng does that so obviously. You can see that joy in his face as he does it.
For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.